Hello everyone, and thank you for attending today's webinar, Using Jupyter IPython Notebooks in Azure ML. Presenting today are Sharuk Mordazavi and Dino Velin. Before we begin, I'd like to cover a few housekeeping items. Today's presentation will run about an hour. The webinar is being recorded and will be available on demand within 48 hours. A copy of today's presentation and recording link will be sent to you via email once the files are available. At the bottom of your audience console is a Q&A widget. If you have any questions during the webcast, click on the Q&A widget and submit your question. We'll try and get through as many questions at the end of the presentation. And without further ado, I'd like to turn the presentation over to our speaker. Sharuk, please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. My name is Sharuk Mordazavi. I run the Python, Jupyter, and the Python SDK and Python tools for Visual Studio team, basically pretty much everything related to Python. And I'm really delighted to be here along with my friend and colleague and employee, Dino Velin, who is the key architect behind the Jupyter Notebooks as a Service on Azure. And we'll be going over Jupyter Notebooks, sort of a part one, which is an introduction to the basics of how to use it. It's a gentle introduction. Later on, we'll have a part two that will go into the intermediate level topics, more about Pandas and scikit-learn and some of the visualization libraries and the R language that you might be familiar with. And then part three, in about 2 months from now, we'll be covering some of the advanced topics like interactive widgets and Spark and perhaps other languages. So with that, I will go ahead and start the presentation. I'm going to switch to my Jupyter window. I hope everybody can see this. Sorry. Okay.
Screen share still isn't showing up.
Okay. I will restart the screen share and hopefully this time it will work.
Great. And Sharuk, your sound is kind of muffled. Would you mind speaking up just a tad bit, please?
Is this better? Is this better?
Sounds good. Yes, that's better. Thank you.
Okay. All right, so
I see that
screen,
it's buffering.
All right, let me know when the screen's up and I will start.
We can see your screen now.
Excellent. Okay, so I've purposely started this in Chrome. As you can see, Jupyter Notebooks are cross-platform and they work from any OS in any browser. Well, on the IE family, you should use Edge, which has support for WebSockets. So what the hell are these Jupyter Notebooks? Basically, think of them as executable notebooks. They're comprised of essentially two types of cells. What you can see here bounded with the gray box is a markdown cell. Essentially, you put your text here. And you have the usual markdown syntax. So if I put a star web-based version of IPython shell, chunks of text and code are organized in cells and so on. And you can see the raw format. And once I hit Shift-Enter, which I'm going to do right now, you will see that, quote-unquote, that cell is executed. In this case, essentially it's interpreted and turned into what you see. Navigation is basically I'm using the up and down keys. It's very mouse and keyboard friendly as an environment. So here you see it's bolded. You can see that I've used three hash marks, and this makes it larger font based on the heading number. Okay, so this gives you a markdown taste for how you can essentially write documentation for your notebooks.
Notebooks themselves are just simply JSON files, and they can be rendered and used as via different front ends. This time we're using a browser-based front end, but you can actually use it at the command line or as an actual app on your favorite OS using a Qt console. But once, more importantly, once you've actually created a notebook, you can convert it to various formats. For one, you can extract all your language cells out of it, such as Python or R. You can save it as an HTML, which is very popular, or PDF, and so on. And you can actually use it as a slide presentation. And interestingly enough, very recently, as Jupyter has become more and more prevalent, GitHub has started natively previewing it. So if you go to, they just made this announcement that GitHub plus Jupyter, and if you have a file, instead of it being rendered as JSON, you will actually see it rendered as as what you see here, instead of just raw text. All right? So we talked about Markdown a little bit. So I'm double-clicking on this cell. As you can see, again, you can have normal text, asterisks basically give you italic, double them and gives you bold, number of hashes give you header level, and you can just do, you know, commonsensical indents to get your lists and indentations. So now that we've basically figured out some of the markdown, let's actually look at the menus. Essentially, out of the file menu, the most important thing is the save command and download as. Those are the ones that probably you might use a lot. You might want to take a notebook, download it as an IPython notebook, and you can use it locally if you're running IPython locally. One thing I should mention immediately is that the Jupyter/IPython system runs both on the web as a service, such as in ours, but you can also run it on your machine locally, and I will demonstrate that as well. And of course, you might want to save a copy of your document. Note that in our system, which is hosted, we automatically periodically save your notebook and put it in the Azure ML Studio world. Okay. Out of the edit menu, basically cut, copy, paste are basically your friends. Once you get a little bit more comfortable with the notebook environment, you probably want to use the shortcut keys, which we'll go over as well. In the cells menu, some of the popular commands are run. Obviously, it runs the current cell, whether it's markdown or code. Or you can run all the cells in the entire notebook, or from this point above or below. Another popular one is clearing output. So you can look at the current output of a cell. Let's say you have a code cell and it generates a graph and you want to toggle it or clear it, you can do that here. Once in a while, the system might get confused, stuck. You might want to restart the kernel. So you go to the kernel menu, either interrupted or restarted or reconnected as needed. But the most important one, at least for me, when I was starting, is the help command. And out of that, all the key Python library packages have a link directly to their documentation, and most importantly, the keyboard shortcut. So here you see all your favorite keyboard shortcuts, and you can use them as you get more familiar with the environment. All right? Okay, so far we've covered the menu system and markdown. Let's talk about code now. So in this cell, I can basically click on it, and I go into edit mode. You see that the surrounding box has turned green. If I hit escape, it will turn gray. If I click on the cell again, I'm in enter mode. So here I'm going to just say print 42, and I'm going to hit shift enter. Note what happens. So what I just entered in that cell got sent to the Python interpreter, and the result was returned and printed on the screen. Now, remember how I can actually clear a cell? So I'll go ahead, current output and clear. All right. Now, a lot of times you just want to hit enter, execute some code, and get a new cell. To do that, you hit alt enter. So here I hit alt enter on that cell, got 42, and got a new cell. The third type of enter is actually control enter. If I hit control enter in cell number 3, note that I executed it and stayed where I was. So sometimes you just keep working with the same cell. Control enter is your friend. So IPython Jupyter notebooks are used for presentation as well. So this means it has a lot of support for supporting different image types and showing them inline to you as part of your presentation. So here in this new cell, I'm going to shift enter, and you see that after importing the display from display, import the image support, and I can give it a URL path, and it'll go fetch that and display it. Instead of URL, I could have said file name equals whatever, and that would look on my local system and display that file. Now, as a teaser, let's go ahead and do a couple of graphs. So here, I'm going to hit shift enter, and we'll see that after importing the plotting machinery and NumPy, I can basically generate a graph inline and view it. Note here that I've said matplotlib inline. Now, that basically tells the system that graphs should be produced inline. If I had put Qt here and I was running on my local system, I would actually get a pop-out with this graph in it, and the graph viewer has a number of widgets and knobs that essentially allow you to pan around and select portions of the graph and view it. But that's not where things end. The Jupyter system has also what are called JavaScript widgets that essentially give you some UI elements that you can interact with. And there's code behind that you can bind to these controls, and they will get executed as you move the levers. This is good, for example, if you want to, let's say, you're an instructor and you want to demo some physics, or there's some values, or let's say you want to do some Gaussian blur of an image and you want to give the users a knob and scenarios like that. All right, so we basically saw that we have Markdown, we have images, you can generate your own plots, and you have access to the entire Python library underneath. One thing I should note before we forget is that by default, when you use the Jupyter system on Azure, you get the Anaconda scientific distro available to you. And soon you will also have the R distro underneath. Okay, so given that when you're working in a notebook environment, you end up working and interacting with the underlying system quite a bit, there are a number of built-in commands that come with Jupyter IPython. By the way, I keep saying Jupyter IPython, as some people may know the system as IPython, some might know it as Jupyter. The way the name change or transition happened is like IPython was essentially built with Python in mind, and then it started weaving in support for multiple languages, but in a hokey way, and they re-architected it to properly support all interpreters and all languages with a nice new architecture, and they call that Jupyter now. So Jupyter is the new multilingual version of IPython. All right, so going back to the system commands, if I just say pwd, you see that I'm sitting on home nbuser 15, which I happen to be where I am. And I can precede essentially any shell command by a bang, and it will send that to the local shell. So here I can say ls, and I happen to be running on a Linux system, but the beauty of Python and having a distro like Anaconda is whether I'm running on a Linux system or a Mac or Windows, in 99.999% of the cases, it just shouldn't matter, as is the case. So here, I want to show you that if I actually hit tab after LSENV, you should get a pop-up. I don't know how much the delay is, but you will basically get file completion as you type, which is very, very nice. So summary being that there's a fair amount of support for interacting with the underlying system and the shell. In fact, let's just go ahead and create a Python file. And I'll see whether it got made. We see that it's there. And one of the new things that I want to introduce are the magic commands. Magic commands are essentially little macros that you can think of them. And you precede those with a percent sign. These are commonly done commands that essentially they just started building into the system. And you can add your own as well. So here I'm using the run magic. And I try to run a file that doesn't exist. And of course, I get the error. And if I run the file that I just created up here in cell number 11, we see that it exists there. Okay. Now here, another interesting magic command to use is percent %load. A lot of times you might have created a Python file already and you just want to load it in one of your cells. For that, you use percent %load. So I'm going to hit Shift Enter here. And we see that the contents of the cell got replaced with print 42, which I can now Shift Enter again, and it'll just run. Okay. By the way, I did mention that we're running on Linux. It's not a lie. The system is built on Linux and Docker. As you know, Azure supports multiple variations of Linux OSs, and the entire system, you know, as far as Azure ML is concerned, is built on Linux and Windows. But if you're using languages like Python and R, essentially you won't even care or know unless you're actually interacting with the underlying system. One more thing that I mentioned, forgot to mention, is that in your code you can actually put direct path to file names, and it will get grabbed and displayed. So yet another way of showing your images. So you might say, oh, there are all these commands and so on. Is there any help that's available in a convenient way? And the answer is yes. So you can put a question mark after anything, and you get a little pop-up window at the bottom half of your screen, which you can scroll around, and gives you some brief help on whatever command you've entered. If you add two question marks, then you get the source and documentation and the whole shebang. Again, conveniences as you quickly working through a project. As you know, Python is not itself the fastest language on the planet, but thanks to all its native modules, you can run some pretty fast code. But what if you're actually running some code and you want to have an idea how much time it takes? Another interesting and useful magic command is timeit. So here I'm doing a range of 1,000 and I'm summing all the numbers. I'll hit Shift Enter. It said that it ran a number of loops, did it 3 times, and here's the average per loop. You can also apply magics to the entire cell. The way you do that is you add another percent sign, and whatever you put in the first line gets executed once, and the rest of it gets executed via the whatever magic command you have. And there are a number of magics. There's about 100 of them. You can look them up. Another convenience in the notebook is when you have a lot of output, it actually gives you a nice scrolling box that you can look at all the output. So here I'm doing a loop printing for range of 50, and you see that it's going to be a ton of numbers, so it just gives you a scrolling box. Then another convenience in the display package is the fact that, let's say, you're creating a tutorial for a document that you're preparing. You can actually embed YouTube videos directly into the notebook for a great multimedia presentation or tutorial, or if you're a professor and you want to teach a class, and you can just have it inline. Okay, so basically so far you've gotten the idea of, hey, you got markdown cells, you got code cells, you got some system shell conveniences, you got these magic commands. So that's pretty nice. Now let's go actually start jumping into some of the Azure ML stuff. One of the key libraries that you basically can't live without is Pandas, as a lot of you guys might know. It's very easy to import some data into it. You can read various types of file. Here we're just reading a CSV file and putting it into a data frame. So here's my input URL. I'm pointing it to somewhere on Azure. I get a data set, and we see that it nicely presents it. And it says that it's 150 rows by 5 columns. If it was a lot more, we could have just seen the summary of it. Let's do some basic stats on it. Count, mean, standard deviations, and so on. All right. But now, so far, I've done everything via accessing the outside world. I haven't done anything with the Azure ML stuff so far. But what if I want to look at my own data sets that are in Azure ML? That's pretty easy to do. So I can go to my Azure ML Studio environment. Let's say I have a data set here. I click on it, and at the bottom, you see several options. One of them is Open in Notebook. And it quickly gives you a Python 2 or Python 3 option. And once you've selected one, it starts remembering that, thinking that you won't probably want to constantly switch between the two dialects. But the one that we're interested in right now is the generate access code. Now, if I had opened it in the notebook, it would have prepended all my tokens and access codes automatically for me. But here, I'm going to show you what this generate access code looks like. Basically, it gives you the glue code that you need in order to interact with your own data set and experiment. Okay? So I'm going to put that in this cell and hit enter. In fact, I'm going to take a look at the frame. And we see that my data set's available to me right here in that scrolling window. Now, the reason I manually pasted this in is because this access code is not just for Jupyter. If you're using Python tools for Visual Studio, if you're using PyCharm, if you're just in an editor and you want to access your world, you can actually do it using our Azure ML SDK. It's available on PyPI. Okay. Now that I've gotten my permissions to access, I can simply do a ds.name on my data sets, and you see here they are. I can access various attributes. These are all the data sets that are generally available. But what if I want to see my own data set? I only have two, and we see that they're right here available. Now, so with this, now I'm going to switch basically to Azure ML slightly before I turn it over to Dino. The general Azure ML environment that you might be familiar with, you know, you've got a left tab that has the experiments, web services, notebooks, data sets, trained models, and so on. The notebooks, currently in preview, as you see in the green preview text, is essentially where all the notebook goodness is. You basically go to the bottom left, and you click on New. And here, you are presented with three options, a Python 2, Python 3, and a Welcome to Studio Jupyter Welcome Notebook. In there, you have a number of features and so on discussed, a lot of it covered by this talk today. Okay. So once you've done that, you can manipulate your notebooks by selecting them, deleting them, and so on directly from ML Studio. Okay? You can also rename them. One last thing for me to cover before we switch over to Dino is that if you are doing a lot of work in the notebook environment, you can click on the top left Jupyter icon, and you will be presented essentially with the same list of notebooks that you have on the ML Studio site. But here you also have options to upload a local notebook, or create a new notebook directly here. You can see by clicking on running tab, I can see which ones are running, and I can shut them down. And I can multi-select and duplicate or delete and so on. So essentially, a convenient way to create notebooks, copy them, manage them, download them, upload them, and so on. All right, so we've covered the Jupyter basics. One URL that I want everybody to remember is nbviewer.ipython.org. In there, you will see a whole bunch of wonderful notebooks on just about every topic, from quantum mechanics to how to mine the social web from O'Reilly, which has basically started writing many of their books in a notebook format. So with that, I'm going to switch over to Dino. He's going to actually build an ML model and deploy it all from the Jupyter notebook. Take it over, Dino.
All right. Thank you, Sharok. I will start sharing out my screen here. And we'll see how to use Azure ML and the Jupyter notebooks together. As I can get this. Screen to get bigger than 640 by 480. You should start seeing my screen here in a second. Okay, it looks like you should be able to see it now. So here I am at the studio.azureml.net website, which is our machine learning website that Sharok was showing you the inside of, and I'm going to go into my workspace, which is where I'm going to develop and train an experiment. The workspace also contains all of your data sets that you saw Sharok enumerating and all that good stuff, so it's kind of a collection of all of your assets. In here, I have my data set that I've already uploaded beforehand from a CSV file, and as Sharok saw you, I can just go ahead and open that, and we'll land in the notebook, and we have our code there for accessing it and displaying it that it was pre-populated. So my data set is some oil prices over time, as you can see here. So we have a date, and we have the price of the oil at each date, and we have several hundred rows of that data. And then I've also created a larger notebook that's not directly tied to my prices by just going through new notebook. And I've done that ahead of time And so we'll walk through what that notebook looks like and end up training a model and publishing that to Azure ML in a way that I can consume that as a web service. So here is some initial Python code to bring in some common libraries which we're going to use. NumPy is a numerical library. Matplotlib is our plotting library for displaying graphs. Pandas is our data manipulation library. And then StatsModelTSA is actually a library for doing machine learning. So I'll bring those in. And to make things look a little bit larger and prettier, I'm going to configure Matplotlib a little bit. And then I'm going to connect to my workspace, which is the exact same code that we saw before, just brought into this notebook. So I can quickly look at a little bit of my data, and we can see that is the same data that we saw over in the notebook from the dataset access code. And I can even quickly plot that data and see what it looks like over time. So we can see price is going along, and then something horrible happens. I can take a sample of that data, and sampling the data is really pretty useful whenever you're doing machine learning, because you want to train against one sample and test against another sample and see how things are doing and tweak your model over time. I can just plot my sample and look at that subset. And finally, I can train an actual model that's going to run against this. So this is using a model. I'm not much of a machine learning guy. You can go up and look at the various models that exist for different things. There's things like binary classifiers, which are useful for doing fraud detection. There are other algorithms like this, which are actually going to give us price predictions over time. And there's a bunch of different sorts of algorithms that work different ways underneath. And there's tons of libraries available in scikit-learn and elsewhere for Python for training these things. So this will train the model. And it's going to put up a graph which takes our model and shows how it predicts the price over time. So we can see here kind of the same graph that we saw before of the prices, and we can see where the model is thinking the price is going to go over time, and it even has a confidence interval that's associated with it. But what I really want to do with my model is, that's nice, I've trained a model, but at the end of the day, I'm going to want to consume this somehow. And the way to do that is to take this model and actually publish it as a web service. And so these few lines of code are actually going to do that. So here, services is the AzureML.services library. And inside of it, it has a number of functions which are useful for publishing things. One of those is publish, which takes my credentials for Azure ML, and so this is my workspace ID and the access token, which are the same values that were used up here above when I created my workspace. And it takes some type decoration so that we can publish this and consume it from other languages in addition to Python. And so this is the input type, which is an integer, and we're going to say it returns a floating point number. So I can look at this forecast object, and it's still just a function. I can call it and get predictions, so that's 42 weeks in advance, or 100 weeks in advance, or 1 week in advance. And that's just running the model locally here inside of the IPython notebook. But using this publish decorator, we actually attached an extra service property onto it here. And this service property is a callable object in Python, and I can invoke that, and it will run the service on the web. I can also look at things like the help URL here, and this gives me an URL that I can actually open. And when I go to this page, I get documentation on this web service. And so I can see I'm going to post to it to do a submit. I need to send some headers into it. and I send it a JSON payload, and that payload will include the week that I want to predict for, and then it will send a response, which is JSON, and it will give me the values back out. There's these extra values, which are actually things like stood out and stood air and any graphics that were produced, and so those can come back as well. I get information that the input is numeric. I get information that the result is numeric. And if I scroll down, you can see I even get some sample code so that I can invoke this from either C Sharp, Python, or even R. So I have my web service up and running. Some of those inputs that I need to give it, I'm going to have to post to an URL, and so I can get that easily from the notebook. And I'm going to have to provide it an API key. And so this is a service that you've published to Azure ML. Not anyone can come along, stumble, and start executing it. They actually need to have the secret in order to be able to invoke it. So you can control access to it that way. So finally, I can actually invoke the service. The first few times you invoke a service, it can be a little bit slow. It's going to there's a server, and a number of servers actually, that are up in Azure ML, which your service will be running on. And so those servers need to spin up and initialize your code for the very first time. So the first time, it might be slow. The second few times, it could be slow as well if you hit a different server. Eventually, you'll kind of get into the sweet spot where all of those responses start coming back really pretty quickly. And so we can see, apparently, we hit a different server this time. But if we wait a little bit, we'll see that it will come back with an answer. And then we can even compare that answer to what we're getting when we run it locally. And they should actually be the same. And they are. So let's just try it one more time. And we can see that time it actually managed to come back pretty quickly because we're hitting a server where it's actually already running. For those of you who are familiar with Python, you're probably pretty familiar with the map function. The map function will let you take a number of inputs and execute it across a function, and it'll collect all of those inputs as a list. And so that is a pretty common idiom, and we support that for our services as well, with this map here. And so that did a single web request and sent all of the inputs across at once and returned all of the inputs back to us. So that's just a way to get a little bit more efficiency out of your calls. And if we try do the same thing locally, we'll see that we're actually getting the exact same results. And that map function is actually really convenient because I can start combining it with things like plots, where I'm going to do a plot and do a map and do the prediction 50 weeks into the future. And we get this nice graph here. And you can see kind of, okay, big, medium, kind of trending out to a more straight line. And if we go and look at the prediction that we had previously when we ran it locally, it's basically the exact same thing. Yeah, looks like I might be buffering. So there you might be seeing the graph now. And there you might see me scrolling up. And there you might see the previous graph that we actually had before. So that's the basics of taking a model and training it. One of the interesting things about how this works is it seems a little bit magical, maybe. You know, here I trained a model inside of my notebook, and I defined a function which consumed that model, and I wrapped it up with these decorators, and off it went, and it's magically running on the server. And so what's actually happening behind the scenes when I'm using these publish types and returns decorators is we are inspecting the function, and we're seeing all of the variables that you've actually closed over. So in this case, we have the AR2 variable which is actually my trained model, and we're serializing that up and sending that off to the server. And so we capture everything that you're actually using and consuming. So you can do class definitions, you can do arbitrary objects, and as long as they're serializable in Python, which is using the Pickle protocol, it will just magically go up and go to the server and just work. You can also publish individual functions that live in files outside of the notebook, and in that case, we'll serialize the source code and rerun your code that gets you into the model, or trains the model actually on the server. And this isn't limited to just using models. You can basically take any Python code that you want. And so, for example, here I can do a function and it looks like there might be some lag here, but hopefully you saw me copying and now you see me pasting. And so I'm just going to define a function which is going to add two numbers. And I will make that add two ints and return two ints. And I'm going to publish that. And then I will be able to invoke it. Sometimes it'll take a little bit before the service becomes available. There's a little bit of lag there as well. And so you'll see this invalid credentials error sometimes, usually it shows up pretty quickly. There seems to be a maximum of about 30 seconds lag before it becomes available. And once this comes back, you can see I've successfully added two numbers. So whatever you really need to put into a web service, this is a great way to operationalize it and publish it. These type decorators are actually also not strictly necessary. So I can drop them and redefine my function. And without the type decorators, this service will really only work with Python because you're not publishing the type information in the description of the API that enables other people to interoperate with it. But the cool thing about that is I can use more complicated Python data structures inside of my service. So again, there appears to be some lag, and so here I'm changing it to add two list objects instead of adding two numbers. And once that's successfully executed, we should see that we get the list after they've been concatenated. And maybe I did something to screw that up, but if I go back to Azure ML, we have a web services pane, and so you can see inside of my I'll wait for that to catch up. You can see here inside of web services, that I have the various functions that I published. And so I can click on one, and I can see the API help page. And so as I develop these over time, I can track them and look at them and clean them up if I need to. But they'll all be preserved inside my workspace. So that's the basics of publishing a web service to Azure ML using the notebook. And I think at this time we're ready to answer some questions.
Okay, great. Thanks, Dino. Okay. Our first question, what is the difference between IPython and Jupyter? And if you have existing Python code, does it integrate with Jupyter?
So difference between IPython and Jupyter. IPython was what initially started this development, and it was very Python-focused. And over time, the IPython developers realized they had something that was more general, which was suitable for multiple languages. And that's when they rebranded IPython and started splitting up the code and teasing out the parts that were Python-specific from those that were really applicable to other languages. And so the name Jupyter actually comes from Julia, Python, and R. And it's the movement towards making this truly multilingual. And they just released Jupyter 4.0, which is kind of finishing up all of the work that they set out to do that. And then there's a second part to that question.
If you have existing Python code, how well does it integrate with Jupyter?
So you can import modules, you can put them on your path, and they'll be available, and you can use them. With our Azure ML notebook service, there isn't a great way to upload them to the service right now, but that's something that we'll expand upon in the future. Locally, it works just the way any other Python module would.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Is it possible to install a Python package which has not been part of the Anaconda distribution?
Absolutely. And so that would be actually another way that you could get your existing code onto the notebook service. You can use pip to install things, which will connect to PyPI, the Python package index, or you can use conda to install things that are not in the core conda distribution but are available in the conda repo. That's a feature that we just added in the last couple of weeks to the notebook service.
Great, thank you. And can you elaborate on the R distribution?
So right now our plan is to ship the same version of R that is available in the Azure ML backend, and that is R 3.1. That's just so that things that are in Azure ML that work today will also work in the notebook service. Over time, we will figure out a story on upgrading R without breaking people, and we will move to a more recent version, and that will most likely be Revolution Analytics, RRO, which ships recent versions as well as versions which include MKL support for doing fast math.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Sharok, did you say something? There's a bit of an echo on your end, so I couldn't really make that out. Let's see.
Okay. I'm having microphone problems, so I'll leave it to Dino to answer.
Yeah, that was completely jumbled. Sorry.
Sharok's having microphone problems, so he's going to leave it to me.
Yes, okay. Let's see. Can I use the same notebook locations to get data from Spark?
That is something that we are looking into. The biggest challenge there right now is, at least with Azure, connecting to your Spark cluster. But we are trying to figure out the best story on how to integrate with Spark on Azure. Certainly, if you're running locally, you can download Anaconda and install that locally, and you can connect to your Spark cluster, which is on your intranet, and that should work with no problems. But the Azure stuff is a little more intricate because of security concerns.
Great, thank you. How do I configure Jupyter to switch between Python 2.7 and Python 3.4? Is this an environment variable?
So it's not. So what Jupyter has, and it looks like my screen is buffering right now, it has support for supporting multiple kernels within the UI. And so when you're in a notebook, if you're seeing my screen right now where it has Jupyter in the upper left-hand corner, you can click on that and you get to the tree view, which I think Shirok showed before. And then on the right-hand side, there's a new button. And you can choose between Python 2 or Python 3. If you're doing this locally, you have to go and register the kernels with Jupyter, which is just dropping in some information in the config file, which points it at your other Python interpreter. It's pretty simple. So my screen might be refreshing. This is also the way that we'll expose R as well. The other way to do this with Azure ML is in the UI, whenever you can choose a notebook to open a notebook against a data set or open it against the output node of an experiment, you can choose between Python 2 and Python 3 there, and we'll bounce you into the correct version, and the code between the Python 2 and Python 3 stuff is all pretty much identical. So hopefully you're now seeing the Python 2, Python 3 drop down. It was there for a second and went away. But hopefully you caught it. It will probably come back in a second. And I hovered over it for a while. And then once you click on that, you end up in a notebook that will say Python 3 in the upper right-hand corner. And so you'll probably see that while I'm answering the next question.
Okay, it seems like we have a little bit of feedback on the line. Oh, that's better. How does Anaconda compare with Python XY?
So Anaconda is, I think, just a little bit more supported. They both obviously care about the scientific distribution space a lot. Python XY includes an IDE, which is an interesting aspect of it. Anaconda doesn't really include anything along those lines. Anaconda gets updated a lot more. Anaconda includes its own package manager called Conda, which is designed to solve some of the problems with redistributing things that live outside of the Python ecosystem. So when you have packages that might depend upon Java or things like that, there's really no good way to handle that with pip today. And so they went off and created something that is designed to be a superset installer. And then other than that, I think Anaconda is probably just a little bit better supported. Continuum Analytics develops it and just announced enterprise support. And so there's all sorts of options for enterprises to get the various support that they need from a company that's backing the product.
Thank you. Is there a way to run all the code at once rather than chunk by chunk?
Yes. So if you click on the cell menu, there's a run all option, and it will just run through the entire notebook.
Great. There's a couple questions about the URL for the Jupyter NB viewer website, if you can repeat that.
What is the NB viewer? It is nbviewer.ipython.org. And it is apparently on the slides. So let's, there we go. So that's a number of, there's NB Viewer, there's studio.azureml.net, which is what we are doing everything through, and which is where the notebook service is hosted through.
I don't see the slides. Is it 4 or 5?
It's 4.
It's 4. Let's go ahead and push that to the audience. Okay. Let's see, does your version of R allow libraries like Bioconductor, or is it constrained to a particular set of libraries?
With R, we'll support installing libraries just like we do with Python. We'll be pointed at Revolution Analytics, CRAN, MIR, and you should be able to install everything that you want. And if you don't want to install it from Revolution Analytics, CRAN, MIR, I think you can just reconfigure it to install from other places. We do lock down web access somewhat. And so we'll have to consider exactly where we open that up once we add our support, but we'll probably include all of the likely candidates.
Great, thank you. Is this notebook available for download?
Is this notebook available for download?
This notebook, I will put it up, but a better version of this notebook is available on the template called Welcome to Jupyter Azure ML when you do a plus new notebook.
So Sharuk said he will put this up, but there's actually a slightly better version. If you're inside of Azure ML, you can click on the plus new button, and there's notebook, and there's a Welcome to Studio/Jupyter notebook that you can choose, and that'll walk you through basically all the same stuff, but it's a little bit more explanatory and has a little bit more inline information in it.
Great, thank you. I think we have time for just a couple more questions. How do we switch between project directories?
So with the notebook service, we don't actually have any concept of directory support. So you can have different workspaces, which would represent different projects within Azure ML Studio. And if you're running locally, you just start IPython from a local directory. And in that case, you will be able to navigate through the tree view. So if you have a folder structure, you can click down in things and navigate up. And it uses the directory where you started IPython as the root.
Okay. And are there any plans for integration with Azure ML experiments? For example, use Jupyter as the code editor for Python R steps with access to data in the steps input ports.
So I don't think we have any short-term plans for replacing the existing editor experience with IPython. It's actually a little bit complicated when you start getting into what we do with multiple cells and kind of the results in between them and how we shuttle those back out. And so we'll have to do some design work before that happens, and we haven't really considered doing that quite yet. It is a great idea. That little editor cell isn't the world's best experience, though.
And let's see, final question, again, about R, lots of questions about R. When will that be available again?
We are thinking that it'll be available on the notebook service by the end of the year. If you're running locally, you can install R today. It's a little bit of a convoluted process. You have to get R and install that, which isn't super difficult, but then you have to install R Python, and then you have to go off and install several dependencies along with that, and then finally you can go off and configure IPython to use that. There are steps out there on the web on how to do that, but once it's in the notebook service, it'll just be connect to the website and you'll have it, and so that should be by the end of the year.
Can you hear me, Dino?
Yeah.
One thing I could add is that essentially R support is in two parts for the Azure ML integration. The first part is actually adding R to the Jupyter service, which we have actually done and is internally available at Microsoft. And the second part is having an R Azure ML SDK that provides you in the spirit of R, access to your workspaces and data sets and so on. That's the one that we're working on, and as soon as that is ready, we'll have both of them available publicly. So we're hoping that we can hit that before the end of the year.
Great. Thank you, Shiroki. You sound awesome. You sound great right there. Okay, I think we're at the end of the presentation. Thank you, everyone, for joining. Again, this presentation was recorded. An email with the link to the presentation slides along with the link to the replay will be sent out within 24 hours.
Yes.
Thank you, Shiroki. Thank you, Dino.
Sure.
And hope everyone has a great day.
And I want to thank you. Thank you. I want to thank you, and I do a shout-out to Fernando and Brian and Min and the whole Jupiter team for creating an awesome experience for data scientists. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Goodbye.